Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
Now we've made it. Spring has sprung, the darkness is receding, and we are ready for the weekend. Welcome to the podcast. You can follow us on Spotify right now for this weekly selection of our favourite chats from the last couple of days. On this episode, the king of kids' books and poo jokes, Dave Pilkey, the Irish nurses working in the NHS, a tip boxer promising to bring titles back to Munster, and visiting critic comedian Julie Jay put her hand to carpentry. First up, kids' comic book legend Dave Pilkey. He talked about being sent to the hall when he was a kid for acting out in school, about teachers ripping up his comic books and even an exorcism because they thought he was possessed with demons. But he was later diagnosed with ADHD. He got over all of that and became a sensation. And we heard the genesis for his famous poo jokes and how he purposely misspells words to fool the adults and endear the wee kids who absolutely fanboyed all over him and fangirled indeed as well. Next then, the generations of Irish people who travelled to Britain to work in the NHS. We spoke to some women who made that trip across the water in search of opportunity and a new life. We heard how Irish nurses were respected for their hard-working ethos, but while the troubles raged, that was overcome by anti-Irish sentiment among some people over in England. It was a fascinating glimpse into the lives of the many Irish who lived in England at that time. And Nurse Bernie from Tyrone, she was the star of the triple interview, and she told us how working in a hat factory with Philomena Begley bored her so much that she decided to make that move to Kent and become a nurse when she was just 17. Then we met the Tipperary woman known as the Carrageen Queen. She's 30-year-old Shauna Brown, talking to us ahead of a big fight in Belfast this weekend. She was a real blast of energy. She brought manifesting to a whole new level when she promised listeners that she will make history and bring titles back home to Munster, to Clonmel and Tipperary. And as she said herself, watch this space. That's Shauna Brown. And finally, Julie Jay took up woodworking as this week's visiting critic. She put her hand to carving, sanding, turning, and made a three-legged milking stool, which is really rather good. And she also talked about the worst gig in her life, which happened only recently, and using humour to deal with grief. That's everything in the podcast, or I'll chat to you on the other side. Now, Dave Pilkey has sold over just a few books, 140 million and counting of his books all over the world, and the comic heroes that you all love and know, Captain Underpants, Dogman, global sensations. And actually for many children, it's their first experience of independently reading as well. The movies, of course, have followed, and Dogman topped the Irish box office early this month, is still in cinemas. As we welcome to the studio, Mr. Dave Pilkey, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Good morning, Oliver. So nice to be here.
You were you're on this incredible world European tour, meeting your fans.
Yes, it's been wonderful. It's been exhausting, but exhilarating at the same time.
And you were in the RDS, the Royal Dublin Society, as we call it, just yesterday.
Yes, yes.
So how did you get on there? Was it all?
It was amazing. It was so much fun. The families were wonderful. The children were wonderful. So much energy, so much positivity. It was great.
What happens when kids meet their hero? When they
confront. Sometimes a little bit like Santa Claus, they're all excited and in line, they come up and then they have this big smile, then they see me and then the smiles sort of just slowly disappear and they're like, and then they freeze up and they forget their questions.
You're used to it.
I am used to it. And you know, if you shake their hand and you look them in the eye and you talk to them, they warm up and then they...
Because you know they're going to be talking about this.
Yes, yeah, yeah. I want to try to make the experience as positive as I can for the kids and the families.
It's a nice thing to do, to meet your fans. There's a lot of authors like to kind of hide away and go, no, don't want to meet the readers.
No. Well, not for me. I spend so much time every day sitting in a chair all by myself, drawing and writing. Mm. So it's really good to get out and meet the kids and the families.
Do people come up to you with poop jokes all the time, trying to suggest?
Not as much as you would think. I do get some jokes every now and then, but for the most part, kids come up to me with like original comics that they've drawn and stories that they've been inspired by the books. And so they're now creating their own stories, which is really gratifying to see.
That's right up your street, because essentially what you did. Mm-hmm. As we were saying earlier, we know all of your creations. We don't know maybe so much about you. Growing up in Ohio, that was home?
That's right. Cleveland, Ohio. Yeah.
And as a kid in school, you were a doodler?
A little bit, yeah. I was diagnosed with ADHD, actually before it even existed. I was diagnosed as an adult, but as a child, I was diagnosed with what they called extreme hyperactivity. And so,
which is a symptom of ADHD.
Yes, that's right.
Other than we're close, but we're quite.
Yeah. So I was always getting in trouble at school. I couldn't really control my behavior. I was out of my seat all the time. So my teacher would send me out into the corridor. And that's where I started creating my stories.
Really? And it was literally you couldn't sit still in the room and you were put outside the door.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I was separated from my classmates. And I missed the camaraderie. And so the one way I had a connection with my friends in the classroom was to draw these stories that I would bring back in and show them. And actually, that was the beginning of Dog Man and Captain Underpants. When I was in year two, I was 8 years old when I started those. Yeah.
It's incredible. Those creations come out of your eight-year-old head. Usually it's an adult author, isn't it, thinking, trying to put themselves back into their shoes. But
there's a bit of that as well. But yeah, the two things that I'm known for are things that started when I was around eight or nine.
And when you were in trouble, I think it was your mother, was it? It was your mum that said, just try and think about the good, what good this might bring for you rather than focusing on you being the bold kid.
That's right. Yeah. My mom has been such a huge, huge positive influence in my life. And that's one of the things I share with the kids and the families when I go out on the road and I tour, the positive influence that my mom had on me. She believed in me even when I didn't believe in myself. And she, I think that she, in her way, she changed my whole world.
Really?
Yes.
Were you popular in school?
I wasn't the most popular kid, but I was well-liked, I think.
I presume the comics would have helped.
Yes. Yeah. the kids really liked to read, especially Captain Underpants. They were very fond of that.
How did teachers respond to your comics?
They ripped the comics up. When they would tear them out of my hands and they would tell me, you know, you better cut out this this silly bookmaking business that's not going to go anywhere.
Why were they so against it? Why were they ripping up your comics?
You know, I think at the time there wasn't really a whole lot of understanding of ADHD and any kind of neurodiversity, as they call it today. And a lot of the teachers just didn't really have the tools to deal with a kid like me. And so they focused most of their energy in keeping me quiet and keeping the distraction out of the classroom.
Were they frightened of what the comic books might encourage among other students? Is that why they were tearing them up?
Well, I don't think they liked them seeing themselves as the villains in my comic book. So when they would see that, like a Godzilla type figure with their head on it, they were not too happy about that.
I gather one teacher took it a bit further and thought that maybe you were possessed by something. Did that happen?
That did happen, yeah. And in my, I went to religious schools. My father was a pastor. He's passed away, but my mother is a church organist, and so I grew up in religious schools. And this was in the 1980s during what they call the Satanic Panic, and they were. I was, a couple of my teachers thought I might be possessed and they performed an exorcism on me.
What age are you?
I would say I was probably 12.
Were you able to kind of laugh at this or was it quite
terrifying? No, I was terrified. It took a lot of thinking and I kept going through it in my head. But for many years, it resulted in some nightmares and just trouble sleeping, just really some anxiety issues. But for the most part, I talked my way out of it. I thought, you know,
really?
I think the positive influence. My parents didn't know that happened. I didn't come home from school and tell on myself. So they didn't know that was going on. But they were such. I always had a safe environment when I came home from school.
Yeah. Did they ever find out about that?
They did. Yeah. Oh, eventually they did. Yeah.
when you're an adult and recovered from it. Did you believe them at the time when they were performing the exorcism? Because you're 12 years old.
I did. I did at the time, yeah, because that's I went to that school and that's what everyone was talking about, and I didn't really know any better because that's the world I was in.
But it's only the 80s. I mean, you're thinking that sounds like something in the 50s you might somewhat understand, but adults in the 80s certainly knew better.
Well, perhaps this was a thing in the United States. I don't know if this came to Ireland or not.
But we've had all sorts of
panics.
Won't get into. Well, I'm sorry, that was obviously a traumatic experience.
Oh, well, I got over it.
But you had a lovely, safe home.
Yeah, I did. And I think that was the important thing for me, that I've always been I think because of my mother's influence, I've, you know, accentuate the positive, as they say. And I've always tried to do that.
And they were quite religious, devout people of faith, but they didn't mind creativity, obviously, in the house was encouraged.
It was definitely encouraged. In fact, my parents both commissioned original comic books for me. They asked me to create a character just for them. And so when I was 11, I created a character called Waterman. And I made about 20 different comics for them. And every time I would make one, they were so good. They sat down with me and they read it with me and they laughed in all the right places. And then they kept them for me in pristine condition. And actually, when I got my first book published, they gave them all back to me. And they're some of the only comics that survived my childhood.
What a moment. Yeah. You probably didn't know that they'd kept them all.
I had no idea. It was very, very moving, very meaningful.
They obviously knew you were brilliant. And they did.
They were always my number one cheerleaders. And I'm very, very grateful.
When did success first strike then? Is it the early noughties when you start getting published?
Boy, I'm not sure. I was 19 when I wrote my first book, and it was published. So I think that was at 90. It might have been the mid 80s, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And what were you publishing initially? Were they always comics?
No, they were. Started out doing picture books.
Okay. Yes.
For younger children.
And when it really takes off, then.
I think it really took off with Captain Underpants. I think that was the big one that put me on the map.
When is the first one of those?
That was 1997 when the first one came out. Yes, yeah.
So you had this extraordinary success, and then you stopped writing for very good reasons.
Oh, yes.
Stopped publishing.
Just for about 4 years, my father was very ill, and so my wife and I were doing our best to help comfort him and take care of him during that time.
Because it's unusual with a very successful author to just suddenly stop, but your dad meant this much to you.
Of course.
How close you were.
Yeah. Yeah. It was just what we needed to do. Family comes first.
How's that grief with you now?
I think it's okay. You know, my dad lived a very good life, and he had a good family. He was surrounded by love his whole life. And so I think you couldn't ask for much more.
You were able to give back the support that he gave you.
I hope
and
so.
That's about 15 years ago or so?
Yeah, close to that, yeah.
Wow. I can see it still affects you now.
A little bit, yeah. Of course. The death of a parent would affect anyone, especially if you were close.
He was, he loved his sense of humor, I believe.
Oh, yeah. He really inspired my sense of humor. I have a picture book that I did called Dog Breath, and he actually gave me the idea for that, and so so I think my dad I think my mom's positivity rubbed off on me, and my dad's sense of humor rubbed off on me.
The perfect mix.
Yes. Yeah
It was just lovely. Is your mom still around?
She is, yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah, in fact, we were able to bring her to New York when we had the premiere for the Dogman movie and the Dogman musical a few years ago. She came out to New York, and I got to introduce her to the crowd and tell her how she's inspired my life and my work.
Do you think of the, when you're going to these premieres and you're going to meet your fans, do you think of those teachers in the mid-80s with their exorcism sitting somewhere watching all of this unfold?
I don't really think about that anymore.
You don't carry the grudge.
No. There's no reason to do that.
What is it with you and dogs?
I just always love dogs. I think that's common with a lot of kids. Kids love dogs.
Did you have one growing up?
I did, yeah. Oh, right. My whole life I've had dogs, yeah.
All the time?
Well, when my wife and I got married, our last dog passed away, and we've been traveling so much and back and forth to Japan a lot. And so we really can't. It's not a good environment for a dog right now, but we hope to get a new one.
You're what I think they call splitters.
Yes.
You live between two places.
That's so right, yes.
That's difficult to have a dog.
Yeah.
But you're dreaming of it.
That's all we dream of.
In the meantime, you've got Dog Man to keep going.
That's right, yeah, Dog Man.
For people who don't know, it starts with Captain Underpants, really, because Dog Man comes out of that.
Right.
Yeah. Well, tell us the plot of Captain Underpants.
Well, the plot of Captain Underpants revolves around two boys named George and Harold, and they're very much like I was when I was a kid. They're just goofballs, and they have ADHD like I did. They're always making comics and stories and getting in trouble, and so that turns into they end up hypnotizing their principal and turning him into a superhero named Captain Underpants.
And And a Dogman comes from this world.
It does, yeah. When Captain Underpants ended at book 12, I wanted to keep this world alive. And so George and Harold are continuing to make comics. And Dogman is one of the comics that they make.
Yes.
And so we get to see George and Harold grow up into their high school years through these comics as they mature, as they come up with different themes and explore kindness and other virtues like that through their comics.
And there are loves. It's written primarily for the kids, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
There are the odd bits and pieces for the adults.
I like to keep adults entertained as well. I hope to have adults and children reading together. I think that that's really important.
Some of my friends reading to their kids says, oh, yeah, there's the odd political thing here and there.
Oh, yeah.
And we're laughing. The kids are going, what are you laughing at, Dad?
I try to keep the adults entertained, too.
that's as close as you're going to go in that. And yeah. Dogman, that must be inspired by RoboCop in some way.
You know, I didn't really think about that at the time. For me, it was really all about kid logic. When I was a child, when I was writing Dogman stories, he was basically a regular dog who kept getting struck by lightning for some reason. It's just kid logic. And so now it's more of a RoboCop origin story, but it's still, I think, in the vein of something that a kid would come up with and think that was possible.
It's the head of a dog.
On the body of a man, yes.
Yeah. And hilarity ensues.
Yes,
and,
hopefully, yes.
It's gone all around the world. The films, what happens to, because you're watching your creations, which you've hand-drawn, you've drawn mm-hmm. yourself, imagined yes. yourself. That must be kind of mind-blowing when the movies come out.
It is mind-blowing. It is. It's incredible. I as a rule, I don't. I'm not involved in any of the adaptations of my work. So if there's a television show or a movie or a musical, I stay out of it. I feel like it's not my place because it's not what it's not my area of expertise. And I wouldn't like it if someone was looking over my shoulder when I was trying to be creative. So I stay out of it. But I've been very, very fortunate because every adaptation has been brilliant. I've been so happy to work with so many creative people.
And successful.
Yes. Yes. Well. Yeah.
If the fans of the books love the movies, then you're kind of onto a winner.
Oh, yeah.
Now, you can't sell tens of millions of books, indeed hundreds of millions, without the odd snipe and gripe, which is, I'm sure you're tired of the focus on the comic misspellings, first of all.
Oh, well, you know, that's one of the things with Dogman that we tried to phase out. It started out with Captain Underpants because the boys were very young. And so there were some misspellings in their comic creations. Mm-hmm. But as they grow older and they continue to practice, their spellings begin to disappear. In fact, by the end of the Captain Underpants series, there's no more misspelled words.
It's a great idea.
Right. And through Dogman, their artistic style improves and their spelling improves, their grammar improves, everything improves because they're constantly focusing on creativity.
So you make mistakes at the beginning.
And right.
You always
right,
get yeah. better. That's.
I do want kids to not be afraid to make mistakes. I've seen that a lot where kids they'll want to be creative, but then they'll be so focused on the mistakes that they'll be stifled by that. And so I think that was one of the reasons why I included those in the earlier books, some of those mistakes, because I wanted them to see that's just a part of creativity. Sometimes you goof up and it's okay. Keep moving. Keep going forward.
And the humor is quite goofy, but you like to put in kind of broader themes as well that will help kids.
I think so. one of the things that with Dogman especially is I think there's a lot more heart in those books. Mm-hmm. With Captain Underpants, it was more about action and silliness. But with Dogman, although those themes are still there, there's a lot of heart. There's a lot of emotion. There's this cat who starts out as a villain, and his child is trying to encourage him to be a better person, a better cat, and it's nice to see that. I feel like kids really enjoy seeing the character development as this cat.
Redemption arcs.
Yes, that's exactly right. Yeah,
Tons of messages. I'll have to come to them now. I have very fond memories of reading Captain Underpants with my son. He used to be an absolute stitches reading them. Dave really got the 8-year-old boy toilet humor.
Yes.
By the way, Dave, and they're spelling it correctly here, which is mm-hmm. D-A-V.
That's right, yes.
The reason for that?
Well, when I was a teenager, I worked at Pizza Hut, and they were making a name tag for me, and they were using one of those old-fashioned leather label makers, and the E was broken. So it just printed out D-A-V, and that stuck.
That's it. It's printed on books. Every conceivable language.
Yeah.
My children absolutely love your books. Love making comics as well. Thank you for the stories, says Emily. So there's tons of people making their own comics.
That's so nice.
I've read lots of Dave's books with my grandson Owen from Carrigaline. That's down in Cork in the south of the country. That's from Mags in Clonmel. Say hello to Dave Pilkey from his huge fans, Grace and Ryan in Carrickmacross. Grace is currently at home from school, sick and listening in.
Oh, get well soon, Grace.
Was a sick day a good doodling day for you if you were home?
Yeah. Oh, any day was a doodling day for me.
If you're doing shout-outs, could Dave Pilkey say hello to my son, Jacob? He's currently doing a project on Dave Pilkey for his special interest badge in Beavers. Love Dogman and Captain Underpants. Tra-la-la-la-la, says Jason.
Well, Jacob, good luck with your project and keep writing and keep drawing.
Beavers, is, we should say, is the Scouts. It's the younger Scouts.
Oh, okay.
I don't know what they're called in America. Please ask Dave Pilkey to say hello to 6-year-old Cormac in Mullingar. He has all his books, which bring him such joy and laughter. They didn't know you were in Dublin, and Cormac is devastated he didn't get to meet you. So a shout out would make his decade.
Well, Cormac, I hope to meet you the next time I'm back in Ireland. My wife and I love Ireland, and we would love to come back as often as we can. So hopefully I'll meet you soon.
11-year-old Simon is a huge fan, wants to grow up to be an author and illustrator. They're going to play this back to him later, says Miriam in Cork.
Hey, Simon. Keep writing, keep drawing.
Killian, who's 9, has never been happier to be home from school sick. So it's working out for both of them. It's almost like they knew that you were coming.
Hey, Killian, get well soon.
Barrett and Ronan excited to listen back as well when they get home, but they'll be disappointed to discover that Dave isn't Irish. It's such a part of their Irish life. By any chance, have you got some Irish blood? Is a question there.
No, unfortunately, I don't.
We can find it if we really...
Probably. Probably if you took a blood sample. There's got to be some in there. There has to be.
Do you realize that the Irish language is one of the languages that your book has been translated into?
I'm very honored to know that, yes. I'm very excited about that.
Futa Futa is the publishers, and Maureen Nivarta translated them. And it's a big part because it's the Irish language didn't get a look out in big international books until recently in the last couple of years. So it's really taking off. So and it's incredible the dates. You did London, came to Dublin, and you're next going to back to Florida, back to the States.
That's
Florida,
right.
And Texas.
Yeah. A couple of days we'll be back in the States.
So you're over, you traveled the world.
Yes, it started on January 3rd and it ends on March 3rd. So 2 solid months of traveling around and meeting kids and families. It's been a whirlwind tour, but a lot of fun.
Your ADHD brothers and sisters in touch. As someone who was diagnosed with ADHD as an adult, it's really moving to hear Dave's almost identical school experience. Captain Underpants was one of the first books that I was able to keep my attention on as a child in the early 90s. I was also a full-time doodler. And a full-time artist, so thank you.
Wow.
That person.
A kindred spirit out there.
They're nice to hear, aren't they?
Yes, yeah.
It's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you, Dave
Pilkey.
It's
so
you're as lovely as they promised.
Yes. Oh, well, thank you.
And we should say Dogman is in cinemas now, and all your books are available in libraries and bookshops right across this country and across the world. Safe travels.
Thank you, Oliver.
I hope you get the little dog at some point.
Oh, yes, me too.
When you settle on Japan. Or America, but that'll be a conversation with yourself and your wife, I presume.
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
Thanks so much. Good luck. Enjoy your day. Sixth of August, 1949, an advertisement appeared in the Connacht Telegraph and it told readers of job vacancies in Britain's newly established National Health Service. There was a recruitment officer, Miss Lavelle. She'd be touring the region in the coming weeks, including Ballina, Westport, Castlebar and Claremorris, looking for any interested young lady of good education over the age of 17 and a half years. And they should contact this Miss Lavelle to arrange an interview for nurse training. And my God, they did. Over the next 30 years, tens of thousands of young Irish women, and it was mainly women, they would go to Britain to work for the NHS. And their stories are told in a fascinating new book. It's called Irish Nurses in the NHS, An Oral History. And I'm joined by two of the authors. Professor Louise Ryan is a professor of sociology in London and she's on the phone. Good morning, Louise.
Good morning, Oliver.
How are you keeping?
Yes, I'm very well and it's lovely to speak to you this morning.
Likewise. And Gráinne McPolan is in studio with us. And Gráinne, you're a former nurse in Britain and but you now live, where do you live now?
I live in Tralee.
Oh, you're back home?
Back home.
You're from various parts of Ireland, but Tralee really is that kind of...
Tralee is the home.
We
moved there in the 1970s and we stayed.
Oh, lovely. Well, you have done an extraordinary job, the two of you, and I want to chat to you together now if I can. The newspaper ads, they got the notice of women, Gráinne, but there were other enticements as well, wasn't it, to lure these Irish women over to the NHS where they had big staff shortages?
The main thing was the nurses' home and also the other opportunities we had to go over to the NHS was accommodation, the nurses' uniform, you were going to get paid. It was like a great whole, nearly like a a hotel package, really, to draw us all over there to the UK. But here in Ireland, you had to pay for your fees, you had to pay for your training, you also had to pay for your own uniforms. You didn't get paid.
Going.
So it was really difficult.
If you wanted to stay and be a nurse in Ireland.
Yes, absolutely. And you had to wait years to get into training. And if you knew somebody in the health service, then you got pull, you got in. But all of these other girls.
They were generally nuns or clergy.
They were clergy, absolutely, yeah. So I was lucky, personally myself. I mean, there was somebody in our family that was able to get us in. But really, all those other girls, they just had absolutely nobody. So they had to go abroad. So the NHS came calling. And they came calling with these wonderful attractions, really, to get paid. To get paid while you're training, that was just unheard of in Ireland.
Wow.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's extraordinary. Mm. And Louise, how many women did you interview for this book?
Well, we actually had 45 participants, but two of them were men, Oliver. So we had 43 women and two men. So, yeah, the vast majority of the people who trained to be nurses were women, of course, as you said. But we shouldn't forget that some Irish men also trained in the NHS. Wanted to include those stories in the book as well.
And it kind of tells the social history because it's exclusively women, isn't it, for the first few decades. And when did the men start going over? More the 70s, was it?
Well, actually, even from the 60s, there were men going over. But interestingly enough, most of the men trained in psychiatric nursing. So there did seem to be a particular route into psychiatric nursing for Irish men in particular.
That is interesting. And these are stories that could have been lost. Indeed, some of the participants of the book have passed away since you even interviewed them.
Yes, unfortunately, very sadly, three of the participants, including one of the male participants, have died. They were in their 90s.
Wow.
And that's why we were so motivated to do this book now, Oliver, because this is a generation that's disappearing relatively quickly. I don't want to frighten anybody, but this is a generation of older people. Most of the people we interviewed came in the late 40s, early 50s, up to the 60s. And they're all retired, and many of them are now in their 80s and 90s. So it is vital that we these stories now before it is too late.
Yeah. And the NHS, I mean, Irish nurses are fewer. They're fewer now over in Britain. But back then, they really relied on Irish nurses from the get-go, the NHS.
Yes. From the moment the NHS was set up in 1948, it was quite clear that they just couldn't staff it. They just did not have enough British people wanting to go in to work in nursing. I think partly because there were just too many other attractive jobs, probably better paid, probably easier jobs like 9-to-5 office jobs in Britain.
Yeah.
So there wasn't the same appeal of nursing in the British context. So right from day one, as you said, with that newspaper advertisement, they were attracting migrants to go and work in the NHS. And it's still the same story today.
How big did the Irish population of nurses become?
Well, we can't be completely definitive because the data was not gathered systematically. But all the sources that we've been able to identify suggest that by the early 1970s, there were about 30,000 Irish-born nurses working in the NHS.
Incredible. And there was 12% of all the nursing staff they had. Was
12% of all the nursing staff, yeah, that's right, yeah.
And the Irish nurse, Grainne, was really a cultural touch point. I mean, the Brits half expected that their nurse would be Irish when they went into a hospital.
Well, the Irish nurse has great popularity all over the world. The Irish nurse is the best export to Ireland has had and still has. I think it's the warmness, the kindness, the compassion, the empathy that they have. They're very kind, they're very chatty. And the biggest thing about an Irish nurse is that they're such hard workers.
Yeah, talk to me about that. Why was there, because a lot of them came off farms, a lot of them were obviously just delighted to have the opportunity, but their reputation was really strong, wasn't it?
Oh, it was huge. And I suppose in those days as well, between the 1950s and the 1970s, 1980s, even to my time, the families were very large. I come from a family of six, so it was expected to go into the convent, into the priesthood, into teaching, into nursing. The career prospects for Irish girls in those days, and even probably up until the 1980s, was really very limited.
Mm.
So nursing was really the ticket out of Ireland, out of that restricted situation that a lot of them would have been left in.
A lot of the women you spoke to, Grainne, had similar stories on the kind of limits to their futures if they stayed in Ireland and the very few options that were open to them.
Very few options, yeah. Career guidance was really limited. Even in my time in the 1980s, it was nursing, teaching, the bank or the convent. And I certainly wasn't going through any of those, really. But I wanted to be a nurse and that was really what I wanted to do. So, yeah.
And you had it in your family?
Yes, yes. My sister is is a nurse as well and still nursing.
Oh,
and fair dues to her. So, but once a nurse, I think always a nurse, no matter what, even though I've changed career about 10 years ago, mm-hmm. you're still always a nurse, still there with you.
What do you mean by that?
I think it's just that the nuns taught me. I mean, I did my training in Ireland, luckily, but I had to wait 3 years to get into it. And I was like an attendant, a nurse's aide, a ward orderly. Yeah, absolutely.
And you're not paid in your training?
Oh, no. Not at all. Not in Ireland. No, not at all. But we were so lucky to get a place in there. But once we got our training, when we finished our training, after 3 years, we were told there was no jobs. So I was on that boat as well, that ferry over to London as well, like all the tens of thousands of others behind me. And, you know, it was a luxury going in the ferry because some of the nurses in our book went on cattle boats from Dublin to Liverpool. I mean, can you imagine that?
Unbelievable. And that was perfectly normal.
Yeah, absolutely normal.
Did you have a culture shock then when you were working under the nuns in Ireland and going over to the managers in England?
Not really, because the nuns were very disciplined.
Right.
They were very regimented. And when I went over to Britain, to London particularly, it was very regimented as well because they still had that sort of, they were still almost like on a war footing. It was really unusual. Yeah. Even some of the ladies in our book who went over in the 1950s were being rationed, and they had rations of butter and sugar and all sorts of things.
That would stick with you.
Yeah. So even the uniforms, everything was very regimented. It was very rank orientated. So it was not too dissimilar to the religious orders back in Ireland.
We sometimes think of the nuns like they're from a foreign planet, but they were just young women like you at one stage.
They were, and they were brilliant. I have to say, I got the best training ever from them.
Well, there were loads of Irish nurses in dramas that I mentioned at the start, and between Brenda Fricker in Casualty, and more recently as well, Megan Cusack is an Irish student nurse in Call the Midwife. There's loads of fans of that in Ireland. And there was also a Nurse Bernie in Catherine Tate's World. And we have a Nurse Bernie who's on the line, a retired Nurse Bernie Nocton. She's in Dunstable now, Bedfordshire. Good morning to you, Bernie.
Good morning. Morning, Oliver.
You went over what year, Bernie?
I went over in 1965.
1965. And where were you coming from?
1965. I was living in rural Tyrone.
Yes. Lovely rural Tyrone.
Lovely rural Tyrone, yes.
Between Oma and Cookstown.
That's correct.
And what was going on in your life that you decided to go across the water?
Well, I was a lively 17-year-old living in rural Tyrone, working 9 to 5 in a hat factory. In a hat factory, yes, in Cookstown. Yeah.
Did you like that?
I was bright and ambitious. Oh. No, I didn't. I wanted to escape the monotony and the boredom. And I thought there must be something better out there. And I got a push, you know, sort of, and There was a lack of opportunity and choice, especially for young women where I was. So the push came. My sister knew someone who was nursing in a hospital in Kent, and she spoke very highly of it. And I decided that I would write off, didn't tell anybody in my family, certainly really? Didn't tell my mum, wrote off. And lo and behold, I got a letter back straight away, inviting me to come over, telling me there was a job, there was accommodation, sort of as Grainne said, this sounded like a dream package. You know, I was going somewhere. So that was the start, and then you had to go into the town, book a ticket, book an airline ticket. I'd never been on a train or a train before.
Wow.
None of that seemed to bother me, as I recall. I got my ticket. My brother, John, had a car. He took me down to Belfast Airport, the international airport. It was snowing. It was a horrible, miserable Sunday afternoon. I'd used up all my money to book my ticket. I had a few, you know, sort of coins in my pocket. He put his hand in his pocket. He gave me a Viper note. And that was all the money I had. So I set off with a few belongings, a Viper note, and that I had no idea where I was going.
None 17 of years of age.
17 years. It's 2 days, in fact. No, not 2 days before my 18th birthday.
Oh, wow.
And there I was.
This became your life, Bernie.
That was the story. It was one long adventure afterwards, though.
It was far from the hat factory. Where, by the way, your maiden name is Begley, and
is, yes.
You're related to Philomena Begley, are you?
I am, yes. I wouldn't like to remind her, but I mean, she worked in the same hat factory as what I did at the time. She did.
That is a good claim to fame. You're in the hat factory with Philomena Begley, and then you
that
become a nurse.
Factually correct.
It has been researched and everything by Grania Louise. And so you go over to Kent. It was hard work, Bernie, as a nurse over there.
Well, at the start, obviously, it was pretty much obviously, more orderly, domestic or that. But the work didn't bother me. I mean, I was a farmer's daughter and, nothing fazed you. But what really did come as the biggest surprise to me, and what I was so ill prepared for, was the culture shock.
Oh.
Within a couple of days of me arriving, I was meeting, with people, different races from countries I'd never even heard of.
Yeah.
I couldn't understand even, the people obviously from Kent or that, and many of them EastEnders, may I add. Okay. I couldn't understand a word they were saying.
Really?
I don't think they understood, what I was saying. the cultural shock, as I say, was something I was probably even less prepared for.
The hard work of moving patients and all of that, very easy to you, but isn't it amazing? It's the culture that was the shock.
Correct. Yeah.
And Bernie, I'll come back to you in a second.
There was a lot of physical hard work, obviously, in those days. You did a lot of manual handling of heavy sick patients. But, I seemed to take it all in my stride.
You're a young, fit Tyrone farmer and you didn't mind a bit.
Correct.
Tough.
That was me.
I want to bring Louise back in here, Louise Ryan. Louise, the culture shock that Bernie mentioned there, the nurses would have come up from Ireland 50s and 60s. They were surprised, I suppose, by life in England in many ways and freedoms compared to home.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, they were coming to big cities like London, Leeds and Liverpool, looking forward to the bright lights and the fashion and, the excitement and the buzz of being in a big city. But in some ways, it was a bit of a disappointment as well, particularly for people who came in the 50s, because as Grania has mentioned, rationing was still in place in Britain in the 50s. And also many cities were still bombed out in the 50s. Mm. And so those cities were not as beautiful and glamorous as some of the young nurses had expected. And in fact, we interviewed one lovely nurse from Cork. I'm from Cork myself. And she said that actually she had far more fun as a teenager growing up in Cork than she did in a very poor suburb of South London, which was quite dingy and run down.
That's amazing.
So the expectation of what Britain was going to be like, especially in the 50s and 60s, didn't always live up to the reality.
Hmm. It was still supervised as well. It was like boarding school, I think, what someone says.
It was, yeah. In the book, we have some wonderful stories, and I hope that your readers are all going to rush out and buy the book, because though I say so myself, it is a great read.
Mm-hmm.
But there's some very funny stories, because these were teenagers, effectively, away from home for the first time, young girls, as Bernie has been describing there. But they were in a kind of boarding school environment. They worked hard. The work was very hard. But they played hard as well. And we've got some great yarns about them sneaking out of the nurse's home to go to dances. They had a curfew, but they got around the curfew by bribing their friends to open the window and let them climb in at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. They'd get a few hours sleep and then they'd be on the ward again at 8 a.m.
Oh my God.
So they were young. They were energetic. And the stories in the book are just brilliant at capturing that.
Okay. And Bernie, you were in Kent. Were you up to devilment?
Well, I eventually found my bearings and ventured into Dartford, and then obviously got the train to London. But at the start, I think Louise is right, you know, sort of there was very few bright lights. I mean, I landed and I was in a room all by the first time ever I had a room to myself, but I had no one to talk to. I'd come from a family where we all talked at the same time. You know, now here I was, I had a whole room to myself, but I had no one to talk to or that.
So you had to physically get out. And you came home to Tyrone a fair bit as well, I think, did you?
I do, yes. In fact, I'm going over there this evening. I am. We'll go over there for a long weekend and obviously if we get together and, you know, we're all still, you know, alive and well, and we have to get the photograph taken to keep it up to date.
Lovely.
But because obviously transport, I mean, I was, 5 miles outside of Dartford. The transport, there was no transport then. I mean, I was restricted by the amount of transport available. But eventually, you know, sort of you get confidence, you get your bearings. And I ventured in and occasionally I saw the bright lights. But as Louise says, it was far more of a culture shock. And I used to look forward to going back, you know, sort of to going to the dances. And obviously the Patrician Hall it was in its prime then. There was all the show bands. And I missed that. I mean, I was detached from, you know, my youth culture at the age of, you know, the age of 17. And the Rolling Stones wasn't quite my thing at the time because, I mean, that was all the thing in Kent.
Yeah.
And in fact, we had the, you know, Mick Jagger's aunt. I mean, she was working as an auxiliary in the hospital. So all we heard about was Mick Jagger and obviously the Rolling Stones. But, I mean, my heart was with the show bands. Getting back to hearing them.
You actually went to Birmingham, and that's where you met your husband. And no culture shock there, because, well, it could have been, because he was...
Well, it was different, and it was made even more challenging, shall we say. But, again, you know, the work was never an issue, and, you know, nursing was just it was a pleasure. It was such a privilege to be in a position, obviously, you know, where you could help people as a qualified district nurse. Mm-hmm. It was something, obviously, I think that people, you know, sort of really looked forward to until the Birmingham bombs went off. And of a sudden, overnight, the culture and, I mean, the atmosphere, it just changed. You couldn't believe the difference. Going in, doing your daily rounds, and all of a sudden there was a cold hostility. I mean, I'd never in any ways choose to change my accent, but I mean, there were snide remarks about, you know, sort of, oh, well, it was your lot.
Really?
And even in the shops, I mean, I discovered that, you know, sort of shops that I used to go to regularly, and I was ignored. You wouldn't, I mean, very quickly discovered that, you know, sort of you only spoke, you know, whenever it was absolutely essential. But even within patients' families that you were visiting or that, there was a very, very hostile anti-Irish and, you know, sort of you would, you know, I was damned by association with my, you know, with my culture, with my accent.
It's incredible just that it affected nurses. And Louise, you go into this in the book, don't you? The great celebration of the Irish nurse in the NHS, and then the atmosphere changes dramatically.
Yes, and we're very privileged, actually, Oliver, that so many of the nurses were willing to speak to us so frankly.
Yeah.
And to share what were often quite painful experiences. And just as Bernie is describing there, we had nurses in various parts of Britain who experienced exactly that. And what was so remarkable about those kind of anti-Irish hostility around the time of the IRA bombing was that it was often relationships that were already long established. So we have one example of another district nurse who'd been visiting the same family for ages, providing treatment to an elderly person in their home. And just the morning after there had been a particularly horrific bombing incident, she was met with absolute anger and resentment and aggression and told she wasn't welcome and she shouldn't enter the house. So, you know, it was really that this could turn so quickly and it was confronting nurses in their professional lives in a way that they were Irish was now the dominant thing about them, the fact that they were professionals doing a job, became less important to the fact that they were Irish and therefore, as Bernie says, kind of down by association.
Terrible.
And we have some really powerful stories in the book. And that's, we're so grateful because those were not stories that were well known or well recorded. And we're so grateful you've been able to include those in the book.
Grainne, it goes on and on because you experienced this into the 80s and beyond.
I went from the frying pan into the fire when I went over in the 1980s. It was 1985 and the troubles were at their height at that time. Mm. And I wasn't really affected by the hostility from the patient's perspective, especially when a bomb went off. It was more, there was one incident particularly that I remember. And it was one of the surgeons in passed me in the corridor because I worked in the operating theatres. And he said after the Canary Wharf bomb went off in 1993, I think, he said, "Oh, your colleagues are at it again." And I hadn't a clue what he was talking about. And then when I turned on the news during my lunch break and I saw this and I thought, this is
got nothing
crazy.
To do with you, yeah.
It, nothing to do with me, but there was other Irish people caught up in that bombing as well, and everybody else as well in London. Mm. So it was very disturbing because I didn't get as much from the patients, really. It was more outside the hospital setting, like Bernie mentioned, going into the local shop that I would be going to for years, and next minute they would a bomb went off, they would stop serving me. Or going into a nightclub or a pub that we would go every single Saturday night. And then they wouldn't let us in as soon as they heard our accent. So I modulated my accent and I sort of made it more like mid-Atlantic and slowed it down. And I didn't speak unless I was spoken to.
It's just, it's incredible just given the celebration they have for frontline staff in the NHS and all of that. But as Louise mentioned, the cultural identity sort of surpassed any feelings they had, generous
yeah.
feelings towards nurses. It's an incredible story. Bernie, you had, it follows your career because you go into management and everything and you have a wonderful career in the NHS.
I have, yes.
Yes. So it comes good.
I would like to think that I gave the best years of my life to the NHS and I was, successful. I had a very successful career in the NHS. I mean, I was at one stage, I was director of nursing for community nursing and then the introduction of safeguarding. So we had that within, by then I had qualified as a health visitor. And that was, again, every part of my career was something that obviously I look back with, in great pride. And I'd like to think, I made a difference.
And you should look back with great pride. And it's a great representation of, first of all, the home that Britain provided for Irish people and the contribution that Irish people gave to them. It's a great, great story. Thank you all for joining us. And the book is called Irish Nurses in the NHS, an Oral Story. So thanks to Professor Louise Ryan. Let you go back to work there in London.
Grainne McPolin
is in studio.
Thank you for having us.
Back in Tralee and Happy Night. And Bernie Nocton, good luck. You're going back to Tyrone. For a bit of a party.
I'm going over there, going to have my hair done, my favourite hairdresser, and to meet all the family.
Well, more power to you. It's an absolute pleasure chatting to you.
And, thank you.
The book is published by Four Courts Press. So thank you all. Now, I want to move on to Shauna Brown. She's a 30-year-old boxer, very well known down in County Tipperary. And around Clonmel, they call her the Carrigeen Queen. That's a good nickname. And this Saturday, she's fighting in Belfast's SSE Arena in a bid to win a world championship. But whatever happens, the fight itself marks an incredible comeback story, which we're going to get into now because Shauna Brown is on the line. Good morning, Shauna.
Good morning, Oliver. How are you?
Not so bad at all. Come here, before we get to the comeback, tell us how you got into boxing, first of all, as a youngster.
Two of my brothers box. I used to go and watch them for about 2 years from the age of 12 till I was 14. I was mad into sports as a very young age. And it was a sport that captivated me. But obviously back then, unfortunately, females didn't fight at all. It was really unheard of. But a girl in my school in first year, she started one night. I think it was the Monday night. And then the Wednesday night I went up. I tried it out. I fell absolutely in love with it. It stole my heart. And it went on from there.
It's like women's boxing seems to have taken off by accident. We're talking very recent times. I mean, you're only 30 years old. This is Clonmel Boxing Club. You always knew, basically, you were going to be a boxer. The brothers, were you doing other sports as well?
Yeah, I played football, hurling, basketball. I danced, soccer. I did everything. I literally, there's nothing I didn't do, to be honest.
Yeah.
But when I found boxing, boxing was the very last sport I tried. I quit everything else I was doing and just dedicated everything to my sport.
You were in. You were in for good. And Clonmel, County Tipperary, what was it like growing up there?
Clonmel, County Tipperary is a bit of a... Yeah, it was a bit of an odd one growing up. Obviously, there was unfortunately there was feuds growing up in different estates and so on and so forth. So, yeah, it was a bit different. And then obviously being in the boxing club and being the only female there was different also. Yeah, it was different. It was challenging, but it made me who I am today. So I'm very, very grateful for where I come from, to be honest.
Yeah, and challenging because your area of the town was viewed differently, I believe.
Yeah, so as a child in school, in primary school and secondary school, because unfortunately I'm from Carrigeen, the wilderness that,
that's
unfortunately
an estate.
Had a bit of...
It's an estate where good people live, but it had a perception in the town.
It did. It had a perception where there was danger there, but the danger was never near my household or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So we were marked. We were painted with the same brush, unfortunately. So a lot of my childhood friends weren't actually even allowed to go stay in my home, unfortunately.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was a bit strange. People don't really hear these stories, but they're actually true stories, unfortunately.
What does that do to you when everyone is looking at you funny in the town?
Yeah, it's not great. It wasn't great at all because you just want a normal life. You are a normal kid growing up in an estate. Unfortunately, there is a feud happening, but it has absolutely nothing to do with you or nothing to do with the part of the estate that you live in. But unfortunately, everybody, word gets around and the towns have this view and they just stick by the view and that's it. Parents, especially because I was friendly with a lot of kids out in the countryside. And, you know, the countryside, unfortunately, look as townies. And, unfortunately, that's the way it was when I was growing up. And it wasn't great because I had really strong relationships with a lot of the friends I grew up with. So not being able to stay in each other's houses. Yeah, it wasn't great
at all. That's totally mad. And everyone knows what you're talking about because there's always an estate in a town that we have a perception of and it's totally unfair. And we're guilty of it a lot of the time. Did this affect you in school as well?
Yeah, so in school, unfortunately, at home, it was a bit wild at home. We had older brothers and so on and so forth. I would have had a bit of a chip on my shoulder going into school. I wasn't a bad kid. I was just more of a troubled kid that kind of just needed an adult to tell me everything was going to be okay.
Right.
But unfortunately, I was kind of marked as being a bad kid and a kid that would amount to absolutely nothing that I was told from a couple of teachers growing up, which wasn't great either. There was one or two really good teachers that did take the time out to get to know what was actually the core of the problem with me. But then others then just seen this girl that had this chip on her shoulder and, they didn't want anything to do with it. Literally told me I would amount to absolutely nothing when I get older.
Incredible, the ignorant thing that people say to kids. But come here, the main part of your story is so incredible is the comeback because there are injuries that pause your career. What age are you when these injuries kind of catch up on you and you have to stop boxing for a bit?
So my very first injury was when I was 16. I dislocated my knee in the ring, sparring, getting ready for an under-18s championship.
Yeah.
So I ended up needing two surgeries at the age of 19. At the age of 20. But yeah. I did my rehabilitation. So after I got the surgery 3 months later, I went back to my surgeon. I was in excruciating pain. It was like the surgery didn't work. I was far off worse after it. And I went back to the surgeon and he said, Sean, you can't box again till next year. If you're going to be able to box, there's a possibility you may never box again.
Oh.
So obviously me being me, because I'm stubborn and I just don't like to hear things I don't like to hear.
Yeah.
I went back to my physio and I went to the swimming pool every day, if not twice a day. And I did my own rehabilitation for 3 months and I got back in the ring. They told me that in the June. I was back in the ring in September. I won the Celtic Box Cup in September, won the Intermediates in October. And I boxed Katie Taylor in the All-Ireland Final of the Elite Championships in November. And then I went on to fight in the Multinations in Stranraer that February. I also went back to my surgeon in January. And they were like, so how's everything been going, Shauna? And I just turned around and I said, I've had a whirlwind of a few months. It's been amazing. I obviously wasn't able to run, but... the way I did it, it worked perfectly for me to be able to get back. And I had an amazing 2 years. I got to box Kelly Harrington then in the All-Ireland final, the elite finals in 2017, which I got beat in a 3-2 split decision. It was a really close contest. Yeah. And she's now double Olympian. But unfortunately, after that, I sustained another injury in the ring. I hyperextended my elbow and I needed 2 surgeries to fix that. It was a rare, rare, rare injury that happens to fighters. It's an American footballer's injury,
right,
from throwing balls. And they told me I wouldn't box again after that because the first surgery didn't work. And 9 months later, I went back and I had to get the surgery. And that surgery was far off worse than the first one. And they literally told me, they were like, you'll never box again. And I put a glove back on my hand. So I ended up taking a career out. I stepped away from boxing completely.
For how long?
For 6.5 years. So from the age of 22 till I was 28.
Yeah.
I became a personal trainer. I did a course with Alan Murphy. And I became a personal trainer in 2017. I opened up a gym and I did that for 6.5 years and loved it. Pursued a career. I'm one of these people. I have to be busy and I always focus on fitness and sport. It's just been the way I've been. And then I moved back from Dublin. I was managing a gym in Dublin in 2023. And I quit the job, moved back to Clonmel, went to my boxing coach October 2023 at 78 kilos and said, if you put in your time, I'll give you all the time in the world. I trained twice a day every day, started a new job in Abbott and ran worked full-time, a shift work, mornings and evenings 1 week. Mornings 1 week, evenings the other week, training twice a day. And I got ready, made the weight and won the All-Ireland Championships 4 months later after being out of the ring for 6.5 years.
It's just unbelievable. It's a wonderful story. And this weekend really is the pinnacle of it, isn't it? You're going to go into the SSE Arena in Belfast. World title on the line?
So it's a world title eliminator. It's a WBC eliminator.
Right.
Yeah.
What are your chances?
I'm going to win 1,000,000%. There's no doubt about it. 100,000,000%.
You're up against an undefeated Turkish boxer.
Yeah, she's 9-0. I'm 5-0.
Okay, that's you've a 5-0 record. 3 of the victories were knockouts. So that's your form going into this. How can people watch it?
So everyone can watch it live on The Zone on YouTube. So the first fight starts at 5 p.m.
Is Saturday.
It starts at 5 p.m. on Saturday. So you can watch it YouTube, The Zone. And be sure to tune in. I promise you it's a fight not to be missing. Anybody that's listening on the air, guys, get and follow my career. Mark my words. I'm going to be the first woman to bring a world title back to Munster, back to Clonmel, County Tipperary. I can guarantee it. And
well,
it will
I believe
be in
you.
2025.
I believe you. Absolutely amazing. And they don't call you the Carrigeen Queen for nothing.
No.
Shauna, you'll have to come into us. You'll have to come into us with a belt when you do it. The Zone, by the way, DAZN is how you spell that. It's a pay-per-view channel on YouTube. So 5 o'clock on Saturday. Good luck to you. I know your mammy is your hero. We'll chat to her when you come in another time.
Yeah, that'd be amazing. And can I just give my sponsors a massive shout out? Without my sponsors, none of this would be possible.
Very quickly, we have to run to a break. Okay, go on.
O'Shea's Hotel, Tremor is a massive, massive sponsor of mine.
Good
and
Irish
Or
business.
Kings. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Shauna Brown. Good luck. Best luck on Saturday.
Thank you.
This week's visiting critic is Julie J. She's one of those women who does pretty much everything, basically. Comedian. She has a podcast as well. She writes a parenting column for the Irish Examiner, which means she's also a parent and she's a teacher and everything. And recently now, there have been reports and surveys saying that DIY in the home is down. People were not taking up our tools anymore in the house. People are struggling with the basics like light bulbs and wiring a plug. What's wrong with us at all? And when Julie J told us about her minimal confidence in a hammer, sure, we just sent her out woodworking for the crack. Julie J, good morning.
Oliver, how are you? Thanks so much for having me on.
Live, bio from Ballinignal Studio in Kerry, where you're living and... But you're very Kerry associated now, I think.
Well, I mean, thank you. Yeah, so basically, so we're coming live from beautiful West Kerry, and of course I'd like to consider myself a bit of a Kerry Kildare hybrid, because my mom and dad, of course, are from Kirkcaldy. So we were always here, so Dingle is definitely home for me. So coming live from beautiful Ballydavid.
Dingle and Dangle, as we have to say. Are there things in life that scare you? That, because you seem to do so much, it doesn't feel like.
Things in life that scare me. Well, I'm a very nervy, neurotic person, Oliver. I am every comedian cliche going. I'm just an anxious wreck. I mean, there's something wrong with all of us. That's why we're all doing comedy. So I'm definitely a nervy wreck most of the time. And I would say generally when it comes to things like comedy, I'm pretty okay. Even though then I was laughing because I was telling your researcher I did have the worst gig of my life last week, and it was a scene. Do you know that scene in The Joker where he comes out? And I had to laugh because only comedians would talk about this scene. That for me was the most terrifying scene. Not when he's on a murderous rampage. It's when he goes out in the comedy club and there's nobody there. So I did have that experience last week, which was it was a real point of learning, because it has been many years since that happened.
At this stage in your career, that's a surprise. I mean, what happened?
It's pretty bleak, Oliver, that it's happening this many years in. Yes, it has been a long time. So basically I was up in Belfast, and look, we don't blame Belfast at all, but there was a few mixed messages. I was doing an Oscuilge. People didn't seem to be aware it was Oscuilge.
Oh no.
So it was the first time ever they were looking for refunds before I'd even stepped on stage, which is a bit of a low moment. So look, I wouldn't say I'm on the fence now about a United Ireland. I definitely still want it to happen, but I feel we need to just push it down the line a little bit.
Just because of that one moment.
I'm sorry, guys, but we're delaying it for a couple of years because I wasn't happy. Not to make it all about me.
Of course, Kerry people only want a 31 county United Ireland. They will exclude Tyrone at all costs.
We don't mind Tyrone.
Monaghan people are very confused about. You talk to people in Kerry now. That's where the viciousness is towards poor old Tyrone.
No, listen, we love people. We love anyone coming here spending their money, basically, Oliver. That's our metric.
Hang on, it's supposed to be a shared thing. Anyway, let's not get into that debate now. We won't solve it.
We just love anyone with cash. Okay, go on.
I last saw you supporting Joanne McNally on the Prosecco Express, and you certainly didn't look like someone who ever had stage fright in their lives.
Oh, thanks, Oliver. Thanks a million. Poor old Joanne now, you know. I mean, things really went downhill for her career-wise after that. I know. Bless her.
Are you a former and then current school teacher? What's all that?
Well, so I am a teacher by trade, which will surprise nobody that meets me, because there is a serious whack of moonter off me, Oliver. But I have actually returned teaching as of this year, because although I do love the comedy, I also love mortgage approval. So I have gone back. I have come back. I had to laugh because obviously teaching in Dingle. Now, I am very much part-time, but it's a lovely school, Public School Kirkcaldy. And I was delighted to get the few hours, but I had to laugh because obviously in Dingle, everyone knows, you know, each other. And it was gas because the first day I went into my fifth years, one of the fifth years said, "Oh, Julie, how's the comedy going?" And I said, "Well, Owen, I'm not being funny, but obviously not too well if I'm here with you, love." Like, so, I mean, it is that kind of, you know, it's very tongue-in-cheek, but should they take no notice of me?
It is true what you say, though, about comedians and mortgages.
Oh, but sure, listen, because my husband, I chose wrong, Oliver, because my husband is also a comedian, and you would not believe how hard it is for two professional clowns in their mid-40s to get a mortgage with two dependents. It's outrageous. I mean, we've gone from 2009, you know, you might meet a fella from Monaghan in the Big Tree of a Wednesday night. You'd wake up on the Thursday morning and the two of you would have mortgage approval. You wouldn't even know his surname. And now, for 120%, Oliver, and now we've gone to the next extreme. So surely there's a middle ground.
And I mean, Fred Cook seems like such a together person. I mean, I don't see why the bank would take one look.
Henry could be listening.
Oh yeah, okay. We might be looking. Obviously he's doing something else. So anyway, we sent you where? Tell us where you went.
Oh, I had the best day, Oliver.
Did you?
I went to the Goose Island Workshop in Castle Gregory, beautiful Castle Gregory. Mm-hmm. And I did a stool making workshop with Gary. I was just thrilled with myself. I just had the best time.
And Gary, who's Gary?
So Gary is amazing. I mean, he is just, talk about a man who does everything. Such an interesting guy. So Gary is obviously a woodworker, but he's also a bit of a historian, a bit of an anthropologist. I just loved him. I could have honestly stayed chatting to him all day. I'd say he was exhausted after weeks. I would not shut up. But it was gas because I was going down, and even the old husband, Fred, I was saying to him, "I'm going down to make a stool. I'm so proud of my stool." And then I had to clarify I was talking about a chair. So just to be clear, because people were getting very confused. So essentially, I went down to make a chair. And what I loved about Gary, because you know, sometimes you do these workshops. So basically, he's all different. You know, he's week-long workshops. I did the one-day one where you come away with an absolutely stunning three-legged stool. And what I loved about it was you're just straight into it. Like, you know, there's no PowerPoint presentation.
Oh my God.
There's no kind of like, you know, going through that. It's just he, and he did say to me straight away, he said, listen, people learn by doing. So there's no point me telling you something. Let's just do it. Now, he's very health and safety conscious and all the rest.
Yes.
But I did just love that you're just straight in there with the plane.
And it's a long day.
It flew by. I mean, it's so basically there's one session in the morning and then one in the afternoon, and then you come away with this. I'm obsessed with my chair. Like I was saying,
I have
Fred,
it here in studio. Fred brought it down for us, and it's gorgeous. I mean, it's a three-legged stool, like a milking stool, you would have called it way back when.
That's what Gary was referring to as. Yeah.
And initially, I had doubts. This is so good. I went, someone just make that from scratch. She's never done woodworking in her life before.
And it's all down to Gary's magic. I mean, it's sturdy.
How did it begin?
Heavy. So essentially, he got the owl legs, and obviously the legs are, you know, I mean, needless to say, like rectangular. And then he put the leg in the vise. And I kind of thought, oh, sure, I'm just going to be, you know, sitting back here as a voyeur.
I nearly broke your stool,
so to speak.
Sorry. It's beautifully turned and smooth legs now on the chair.
Thank you. It's been a long time since somebody has commented on my smooth legs. So thank you so much,
beautiful.
Oliver. So we put it in the vise and then essentially just started off planing. So obviously the rectangular leg had to go curvy. So then we put, my favourite bit was we put the leg into the lathe, and then I was turning that, and like it's proper, you know, it's proper woodworking. I mean, I'm a woodworker now. I really feel, I said to Fred in the evening, I said, I think I could rewire our house at this point. I just was so confident when I left. So we did the turning on the lathe. We did three legs. So I was kind of relieved now with that because I thought it was going to be four legs. So I was delighted.
There'll
with
be
the
three and no more. That'll be it.
So I was delighted with the three as a mother of two small children. So I was like, oh, this is great. And then, do you know, I loved as well, even the gluing. Sure, I thought we'd just whack a bit of PVC glue on. But as you can see, like chair is unbreakable.
I'm looking at the arse of the stool now.
We did the joint. We did the drill. Now, the drill was a little bit scary.
But there's
Gary
drilling involved as well.
There's everything involved.
All sorts of tools. My God, the puns write themselves, really.
And do you know what? Well, it's funny because I kept saying to Gary, what weapon are we using? And he would have to correct. No, tool is the word. Tool is what we say, not weapon. But it was really wonderful because you get to do all the skills. So you're turning, you're sanding, you're planing, you're drilling. You do everything. I cannot speak highly enough. Everyone would love this. It's an entire day where you essentially do all the basic woodworking skills. And I just could not get over how much knowledge I came away with.
I put the stool on my Instagram story. I thought you would have done it. I mean, I'm useless at Instagram, but it's up there for people to look at. I mean, it looks like a proper thing that you'd pay quite a lot of money for.
Oh, 100%. I mean, Fred couldn't, like the hubby now cannot believe it when I came home with it because it is a legitimate piece of furniture. So
lovely
again,
face from your husband, obviously.
Well, I mean,
he
couldn't believe it. But I think I kind of thought, I knew I was making a chair, but you know the way you kind of think to yourself, oh, I'll be coming away with the spice rack kind of thing. But it's actually something you can sit on, and it's just
fully,
so it's a wonderful thing to do. And then also, which I hadn't factored in, but Gary was only saying to me as well, so obviously he gets a lot of, you know, people around Castle Gregor and their Alibobs and all the rest, but if the weather's bad, it's just the perfect thing to do of a day.
Very good. And it's Goose Island Workshop,
yes,
which is in the Gaeltacht area of Kerry, over on that side of things. So you're flat out busy. And Camille, I'm very sorry to hear that you had a tough time there in the last few months. You lost your dad.
I did. So it wasn't really expected. So obviously my mother-in-law actually passed away at the end of November.
Yeah.
And then it was a very surreal moment in time, because then 2 weeks later, my dad actually got a stroke and passed away. So he was buried in beautiful Dingle on the 23rd of December. So the day before Christmas
really?
Eve. Yeah.
That was Johnny Johnson.
Yes. And he was an amazing person.
Very well known, wasn't he?
Oh, he was hugely popular. I mean, I had to laugh because, you know, so many people came up to me after his death and said, you know, he was the real comedian in the family. And you know, it was such an Irish thing to say, but also so true.
Was it?
He really was. He was very, very funny. You know, he was just a gas man. I think that's kind of why I got into comedy, because that was always our language, I suppose. We always dealt with things with humour. So I had to laugh even for his eulogy. I decided to make it funny, Oliver, which was, you know, I mean, an artist's choice. Yeah. So I didn't elicit many laughs in the church at Dad's funeral, but I you know, it was a tough crowd, you know, yourself. But I wanted to do for him because he was such a funny guy. I really wanted to make it funny. And I did say, you know, even in it, I had to laugh. He actually took the re-election of Donald Trump as a personal affront. Okay, so I think that could have been what pushed him over the edge. So look.
Did you say that?
I did mention that. So again, I've got a few head shakes in the audience. But look, Dad would have appreciated it.
Ah, that's lovely. He was a Garda.
He was a guard. He was a guard for many, many years. And he was a big reader, like super smart, hated injustice, and just great crack as well. He was just a gas man.
People were coming up to you telling you to get onto RIP.ie. What was that about?
Oh, yes. So I did have to laugh because so many people were, well, people were telling me to go onto RIP.ie because he got so many comments and so many people. It was funny because so many people said to me they had never seen so many comments for somebody. So I still haven't brought myself to go on RIP.ie, but because I kind of felt like, look, I'm not going to learn anything about my dad that I didn't know from RIP.ie, if that makes sense. And I suppose I still probably am emotionally ready to do it, but I did giggle because Mom was saying, you know, a lot of the guards, because he was a guard, you know, you might have a message. I think his number was 700-818 or something, and then they'd write up messages on RIP.ie. They would see a message and it would be from 700-819, and it was okay. Real, like, as in, you know, you'd swear they were James Bond, like CIA yeah. levels of, you know, cloaks and kind of cloaks and daggers, I suppose, with the official numbers. But it was lovely, and I did make the joke again, you know, I don't know, it was the eulogy, the place, but between my mother not dying and my dad dying right before Christmas, the Chris Kindle was tricky. It really was. Because half the people were deceased. But we still played
you went
on
there.
With the Chris Kindle, Oliver, which is fairly impressive.
You got a very nice message, a text from a friend of yours.
Oh no, who?
Well, there's a story about you, isn't it? About losing a parent, and this is a club nobody wants to be in.
Oh, yes. Well, I did, because I write for The Examiner. So I did mention this in the column that I got a lovely... I did have a lovely exchange with somebody, and actually, funny, it wasn't even somebody I was particularly close to. It's interesting how in these moments of grief that people can come out of the woodwork, pardon the pun, because we were just on about woodwork.
It's perfect.
And really, you know, say something that connects with how you're feeling. And somebody did say to me in Dingle, it was actually when I was in, I was doing the Christmas shop on Christmas Eve. So we were very lastminute.com because we'd only just did the funeral. And she came up to me and said, look, Julie, you're in a club now that nobody wants to be in. And then I did say to her, I said, can I ask, you know, does it get better? Because obviously it was totally heartbroken. Myself and my dad were exceptionally close. You know, I can honestly say I don't think anyone will ever love me the way my dad loved me. You know, it was the purest form of love. And I did say to her in that moment, I said, oh, you know, can I ask, does it get better? And true to West Kerry form, she said, well, look, no, it doesn't get better, but you do learn to live with it.
Yeah.
And actually, those words of honesty in that moment, it did momentarily sting, but it gave me such comfort. It did.
Oh, that's lovely. Thank you so much, Julie J, for the conversation,
Oliver.
And for the beautiful stool, which we'll send back down to you, obviously.
Oh, I'm not letting go of that stool.
And I must mention as well that you're an ambassador for Seacht an na Gaeilge, Le Energia.
Yes.
So say Gora Mai Agat if we can. So that's what we'll say, Gora Mai Agat, agus slán.
Agur Mai.
And there you go. Some great interviews from the past week. It's the end of the podcast as you know it. If you have interesting stories and things you think we definitely should know, pop us an owl email anytime at all. Oliver at rte.ie. Happy weekend to you. August Sloan.